tonight on Arena. We unwrap Diane von Furstenberg's famed rap dress, and Lancome Sean Warner and Kate Nash are the albums up for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena, or indeed you can watch us live on rte.ie/arena. Diane von Furstenberg is known for creating a dress, not any old dress, but a dress that was to be the preferred choice of women searching for liberation in 1970s USA. The wrap-over dress, often patterned, allowed working women to look feminine without too much fuss. The woman behind the dress, Diane von Furstenberg, was quite the personality. Born after her Jewish mother, who was liberated from Auschwitz at the end of the war, Diane grew to be a young woman who became the centre of the hedonistic New York social scene. Strangely, it was TV coverage following from the Watergate scandal that provided the inspiration to create the famed wrap dress.
In 1973, Nixon was in trouble.
I condemn any attempts to cover up in this case, no matter who is involved.
One day on television, I saw Nixon's daughter defending her father. She was wearing my little wrap top with a matching skirt. And I thought, oh my God, maybe I should turn it into a dress. That's when it all clicked.
Disney have just released a documentary on the life of Diane von Furstenberg called Diane von Furstenberg, Woman in Charge, and Ruth Barton has been watching it for us. Ruth, while I knew about the dress, I think it made a comeback in the 1990s or the noughties or something.
It certainly did. And I mean, I should say neither you nor I is actually wearing one this evening.
Nor never have I, nor, have you?
No, never. They never quite did it for me, but they did do it for millions of women.
But I didn't know very much about her.
No, and gosh, you will know a lot more after you've watched this documentary, because, you know, is this documentary about the wrap dress? Not really. This documentary is about her extraordinary life, and you touch on the fact that her mother was released at the end of the war from concentration camp, and that's sort of one of the extraordinary things. But this is not a misery story. This is a story of someone, perhaps because of her mother's terrible experiences in Auschwitz, determined to enjoy life right from a very early age. And so the documentary, which is an interview with her and then interspersed with copious archival footage of her incredible lifestyle in New York, it's really a celebration of her sexual freedom, let's put it like that.
Yeah, we meet her, first of all, quite extraordinarily. She's climbing up into a sink,
yes,
in a bathroom, and she's soaking her feet and looking at her, what she calls her wrinkled face in the mirror.
Yes, and she's got she's von Furstenberg. Now, she's von Furstenberg, as she explains in an actually delightful interview, archival interview with Letterman at the beginning. He says, how do you become a princess? She says, you marry a prince. And that kind of sets the tone for this really matter-of-factness about this celebrity life. And then, as you say, we see her, and she's just kind of daubing at herself, and she's good, obviously, but she's putting on her makeup, but she's explaining that she doesn't see why you should hide your wrinkles, because your wrinkles are about your life. They tell the story of your life in your face, and she doesn't want to hide that.
A life she truly lived. So she married this Prince von Furstenberg, which was a bit of a scandal for the von Furstenbergs, because obviously she was the daughter of a Jewish woman, that you said. She had her mother, Lily, had her after she had escaped from Auschwitz. So here Diane, with the help of her mother, tells her origin story.
18 months before I was born, my mother was in Auschwitz.
You know, I was in the concentration camp, and I was very skinny and sick. When I come back, I was only 44 pounds.
She survived the death camp. Her parents could not believe that she was there alive. And her mother fed her like a little bird every 5 minutes. properly before. And within 6 months, she had gained her normal weight. Her fiancé, my father, came back from Switzerland. They planned to get married. And the doctor said, yes, you can get married, but you cannot have a child. The doctor said, you, the mother, will not survive it, and your child will not be normal. And sure enough, I was born 9 months later. And in a sense, I was not normal.
That's Diane von Furstenberg there telling about her birth. And we'll get back to the trauma her mother suffered and how it comes out later on in her life shortly. But that idea that she not being normal, she goes to boarding school and there she discovers sex.
Some boarding school. She's sent off to boarding school and she doesn't draw breath. So presumably at boarding school, there doesn't seem to have been a time lapse. She discovers sex with both men and women in short order. And then she just follows on this education with basically her third level education is to discover sex everywhere else. And she, you know, she's in Paris, she's around Europe, she's in Europe, she is Belgian, in fact. But then, of course, she meets this gorgeous Prince Egon, and you have to see the documentary to appreciate his good looks. But he's as promiscuous as she is. And for him, again, you know, I get the impression maybe a little bit more gay but than bisexual, but really, you know, anything goes.
Yes, because she had plenty to occupy her.
Oh, absolutely. They were both having a lovely time until she discovered she was pregnant. Oops. Of course, as you said, you know, his family, who are genuine aristocrats, were horrified that this, you know, basically impoverished Jewish woman from nowhere has got designs on her son. And there's a lovely shot of the family castle, and she's going up to saying, she remembers going up to it and thinking, will they poison me? But no, he insists, and they get married, and they have two children, who of course are called Tatiana and Alexander. But that does not motherhood does not hold her back. Fatherhood does not hold him back. And they continue until their divorce. And ultimately, I'm not giving much away to his death from AIDS. They continue to lead extraordinary but separate lives.
Yes, because this is the pre-AIDS New York. I mean,
yes,
it's coming, but people are not aware that it's coming.
Absolutely. It's post-pill pre-AIDS.
Yes. And it's like Studio 54 and everybody's having, I mean, nobody's having twosomes. It's far too boring.
Oh, no. Twosomes are far too boring. In fact, she reveals that she had a twosome with Warren Beatty and Ryan O'Neill at the same weekend. But in an act of, you know, extreme sort of purity, she turned down an offer from David Bowie and Mick Jagger, who thought that it might be fun for them to have a threesome with her. I mean, she's kind of saying, well, actually, yeah, it's kind of like... it's been done before. Basically, she wasn't that interested. And she said, it'd be a great story to tell my grandchildren that I turned down David Bowie and
Now,
Jagger.
Lest we be accused of being hedonistic ourselves,
we should
back to the dress.
Oh, the dress, yeah.
Yeah, so how did she get the idea? Like, was she a designer? Was she a clothes designer?
No, she wasn't. I mean, she was in the world of fashion because that's what she moved in, and she moved in very wealthy circles. But she was evidently interested in design, and so what she started sort of on the side almost to design in New York, and she did, you know, we get in that clip that you played with the Nixon clip, she the first thing was she modeled the wrap top on watching ballerinas, the gear that ballerinas wear, and that kind of took off, but not really, and it wasn't until she turned out the wrap dress. And she talks in an interview about how she basically had no business training. She had no idea how to sell this. She was, you know, turning out minimal amounts until it took off. And suddenly she was selling it literally in the millions.
As she tells in the documentary how she went to Italy to look at fabrics. And then she began to see the possibilities of a simple dress with pattern.
On my 20th birthday, Egon invited me to Cortina. And that's where I met Angelo Ferretti. Ferretti had a printing plant in Como, Italy. He would make scarves for Gucci, Ferragamo, all of the big Valentino, whatever. And he said to me, you should come and see where they make fashion. So Peretti also wanted very much to get me in his bed, but I didn't. Anyway, it just so happened that I was there at that time. He had the idea of making printed T-shirts out of jersey. And I thought, oh, there's something cute there. And I love the idea of these T-shirt dresses. So I started to stay late, you know, with a pattern maker and make a few samples here and there. I was inspired by the little wrap top that the ballerinas used to wear. So that was the inspiration.
There she goes. No filters again, Diane von Furstenberg there. Absolutely she always none. Tells you what the man or the sexual interest is in whatever artistic endeavor
yeah,
she's
and I mean,
engaged
she's,
in.
She's good because what she's saying is men are entitled to behave like this. Why should I not have been entitled to behave like this? And you know, she at one stage she refers to herself, and she said this before actually in an interview, but she's, you know, she refers to herself as a woman in man's clothing because she didn't want to be, you know, held back by being a woman. And ultimately she wasn't, because she had sex with whoever she chose to have sex with. Plus she had an amazing, and still has, an amazing career. And she also, I mean, you know, you can quibble about her self-description as a feminist, and many would, and it, she certainly doesn't fit into that sort of rather dour image of feminism, particularly in the 70s. And she's no killjoy on sex. But she did produce a dress that the ordinary woman could wear and feel great in, and it was well within the reach financially of most women. And you could wear it to work, you could wear it out. And again, it's you know, she was the documentary shows us the women in the, they're slightly later, but those kind of squared off, rather masculine,
yes,
you know,
the
shoulder
power
pad,
dressing,
the power dressing
of Dallas. Let's
yeah,
say.
Yeah, no, yes, that's right. And she said, dynasty. Why should women have worn men's clothing to go to the office? Why could women not look like women? And so there is, I mean, she is very clear on her, that one of the things that motivated her was to create fashion that women, ordinary women in the street, could wear and feel good about themselves wearing.
How did you think of how they made the documentary? It's very much talking heads. Like her interview, I agree, is wonderful. You can
oh,
see
wonderful.
There the colour and her openness and her, every little bit of tittle-tattle is shared. But then they have the talking heads. They have the Oprah Winfrey's. They have Hillary Clinton. It's almost who's who in the Democratic Party saying how liberating her dress was.
Yes, I mean, it's called Woman in Charge, and this is the woman in charge of this interview is not the two documentary filmmakers. It's von Furstenberg herself, and she absolutely says she controls the camera, she controls the narrative. This is her story, and again, it's different to other celebrity documentaries because she's alive and telling her own story. Whereas, you know, in other celebrity documentaries, the trouble is the celebrity is you know, not able to tell us their story any longer. But it is a very, very conventional documentary. It is shot in an incredibly conventional manner. It is, as you say, you have these interviews, people like Clinton and so on, who are really there, I thought, to lend some kind of intellectual heft to what's going on. But hey, who's looking for it? and they're not really, they're kind of there, as you say, for who they are rather than for any real part in her story.
But there is a poignancy about it. There is the mother's story. The mother's story is such a strong, I mean, her mother seems to be her best friend and her
yes.
confidant. And then there's the story she tells about the mother later when she hears the German voice.
This is a shocking story. So her mother seems to have internalized the trauma of Auschwitz. Until much, much later in life, they go to this hotel in Germany. Her mother goes, she's not with her at that point. And she gets this urgent phone call from the hotel because her mother's gone into the hotel and she's heard loud male voices speaking German. And suddenly the whole traumatic part of her life just comes on top of her, and she has a total breakdown and is found kind of cowering in the lobby away from the Germans, and she has a complete breakdown and has to be, you know, looked after. So it is a really poignant and telling moment. The documentary doesn't dwell on it, and it you know, possibly could have teased that out a little bit more, that how she, as the daughter of an Auschwitz survivor, has, how that has affected her life. She mentions it. I thought it was very interesting. And even how, you know, trauma passes through generations, even her own children, how that has affected them.
Yes, and how did her children cope with the lifestyle that Diane von Furstenberg decided to live?
Yeah, again, I thought this was perhaps the only crack in the documentary where you actually get it, two people saying quite different things, because her son is saying, yeah, I had a normal life. I had a normal childhood. I got up in the morning. I didn't know who was coming out of my mother's bedroom. But that was fine. That was my life. And whereas her daughter says, it was almost abuse. I was so neglected. And, you know, if it hadn't been for Lillian, her grandmother, if it hadn't been for her stepping in and bringing us up, I wouldn't have had a childhood. So I did think that was the one kind of glimmer.
And where Diane's response?
My children were in my heart. Her children were in her heart when she was cavorting with a Brazilian beach bum on holiday in Bali. That's the moment she tells us that. So, yeah, it's fine to have your children in your heart, but maybe, you know, a little bit around the breakfast table too.
Worth watching.
Absolutely, certainly. It's a riot.
Ruth Barton, thank you so much. Diane von Furstenberg, Woman in Charge, is on Disney Plus from Tuesday, June the 25th. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Last Tuesday, Liz Cootey's play, The Sugar Wife, opened at the Abbey Theatre Dublin. The play, directed by Annabel Cumman, is set among the Quaker community in Dublin in the 1850s and poses moral and ethical questions that have become even more tangled today than when it was written first and first performed by Rough Magic more than two decades ago. Peter Gaynor and Siobhan Cullen play the affluent Dublin couple Samuel and Hannah Tewkley, whose world is challenged when two visitors come to stay, the anti-slavery campaigner and freed slave Sarah Worth and her English abolitionist companion Alfred Darby, played by Thierry Porter and Chris Wally, who was in Talking to Sean a week or two ago. Helen Meaney has been to see the production and joins me in studio now. Helen, you're so welcome. So sugar is a tricky subject, isn't it, in The Sugar Wife? The Samuel and Hannah. Samuel is the man who runs the import business for his company, bringing in sugar and coffee and tea. And they are similar in ways maybe to the Bewley families, which would have established its cafes in the 1850s. So the 1850s in Dublin, a time of famine in the country and poverty in the city. What are their lives like, this Quaker family?
Yeah, it's really interesting, that famine backdrop, because the Tewkley family business is trying to persuade people to spend money on tea and coffee, you know. So it's what would have been considered to be luxuries, you know. They are very strict Quakers, and they live in an, you know, an opulently plain house in Ball's Bridge. And Hannah Tewkley, the wife of Samuel, the businessman, is troubled by her conscience, and she is,
because of their wealth,
and also she wants to have a role in life other than just being a married woman, and they don't have any children, so she has time on her hands. She has a very strong kind of social sense of social justice, so she spends a lot of time visiting the poor and sort of doing good works, raising money. And she is one of the Dublin Society of Abolitionists, so she's very, very involved in the anti-slavery movement. So, you know, and there was one, particularly among the Quakers in Dublin at that time. So that's the reason why these two house guests arrive. It's because she wants to invite them.
Now, what is the relationship between the two people in this couple, Samuel and Hannah Tewkley? Are they happily married? Is she very happy with the wealth he provides?
No, I think she is really troubled and feels a lot of guilt about it. And they are not happily married. I think what becomes evident almost immediately is that there are tensions in their relationship, and that Samuel would love to have children, and it hasn't happened. They've been married for about 13 years. But also Hannah is not keen on. Is not as what's the word? She doesn't see him as upset about it as he does. So that's the kind of relationship that the strangers come into.
So tell us about the two strangers and what do they do to the dynamic?
Well, they I suppose, you know, in classic, it's a classical sort of dramatic device that. Yes. Their presence creates a series of ripples, and it makes Hannah and Samuel change their perspective on their lives. So they're very taken initially with Sarah and her story of being a freed slave and her dedication to the cause and so on, and also by Alfred, and he's a photographer. He's a pioneer, really, in early photography, making daguerreotypes, which, with all his equipment. And he shows some of his images, that he shows them in private to Samuel, and he doesn't want Hannah to see them. And that's really when it gets complicated. And that's when a whole load of secrets start to emerge.
And what can you tell us about the images?
The images are essentially pictures of... poor women, enslaved women, and they're quite exploitative and voyeuristic. So Alfred is drawn to taking images of people in sort of positions of degradation, and he shows photographs of Sarah when she was enslaved in chains and naked. He shows those images to Samuel, and Samuel then says, "Oh, would you take a photograph of Hannah?" Which, you know, immediately
it's not what you'd expect.
Absolutely, as they would say in the play, not Quakerly. So it gets very, very unQuakerly, Kay, from then on.
All right, and then what does, like, Samuel imports sugar, as we said. So what does Sarah, who herself was brought up in a sugar plantation, what does she think about that? Is there tensions between Sarah and Samuel?
There's a fantastic scene where she goes to the warehouse and Samuel is being very sort of, look at me, the lord of, you know, of commerce, and telling her all about the sugar, the methods and the process. And she's saying, yes, I know, I remember that, because she actually was born on a sugar plantation.
Mansplaining the sugar manufacturing.
He realizes this is her life, and of course he has been hiding the fact that he has been importing sugar that is from a slave plantation, you know. So, and he has not told Hannah that. She thinks that it's all coming from the Caribbean, from freed slaves. So that's one of the secrets that emerges, and I won't tell too many more. But so she understands things about Samuel that she didn't know before, and that's because Alfred tells her. So he deliberately stirs up trouble.
Yeah,
he's a very tricky character, Alfred.
Yes, I was just going to say, after you talked about the photographs, I thought Alfred can't be up to any good in life. Like, he's accompanying this freed slave where she's going around giving speeches, yes, about, you know, why there should be abolition of slavery.
And he bought her slavery. This is the crucial thing. He paid for her and then gave her freedom. And they are now bound together. It's a really complicated relationship. And in fact, it is the lucrative lecture tours that Sarah gives that's actually funding him. So there are lots and lots of questions here about relationships and who's paying for whom and who's turning a blind eye to the source of wealth, and where does money come from for all of Hannah's good causes? How does Alfred live? He's pretty much dependent on Sarah. And so these things come out.
So there's great stuff in this, like great ideas punching up against each other. So how is it executed, both in the writing and in Annabel Common's direction?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a play of ideas. So it's all about the arguments, and they are as in the presentation of an argument between these characters and the confrontations that ensue. So it's really quite a literary play, and it uses a lot of metaphor, recurring themes of light and reflection and perspective and all these things. So it's not the easiest play to stage. And so it's.
Do you mean it's a very talky play?
It's all about the language. It's all about the arguments. In that sense, very much in the tradition of Ibsen and Shaw and so on. So it's talking about moral questions. How do we live? What is the good life? And so the setting, I think, cleverly in Annabel Common's production is the Quaker meeting house where they meet weekly. And so we see them there at the beginning and at the end. And it's very plain grey, wooden, steely grey, muted. And the opening scene is almost like a ghost story or something. It's so pale and grey, it's sort of sepulchral. And then gradually, as we go into the second half, more colour appears. And but it's a very simple staging with very, very little furniture. So it's sparse, reflecting that very restrained way of life. And I mean, there's so little furniture at times you think maybe the actors would like to sit down, because they are standing for huge amounts of time. Even when they're undressing, going to bed, they're standing and there's no bed, you know. But that's a minor point.
And let's talk about the casting, because Siobhan Cullen, who is, of course, we can see her in Obituary and we can see her in many other shows, Auntie the Dry.
Yes, Bodkin.
Bodkin, yes. Exactly. I mean, she's quite a star get for the Abbey, and she's playing Hannah, and then Peter Gaynor, who's playing Samuel, and then Chris Whalley, who's playing Alfred, and there's Terry Porter, then she's Sarah, and Shifra Niealy, is that right, who's playing Martha Ryan, who I don't think we mentioned that character.
No,
yet.
she's a young woman and in extreme poverty, and she has syphilis and she's dying, and she's one of Hannah's kind of good causes. Hannah's trying to teach her how to read, but Hannah's very, very naive about this character and actually what her life is like. So they go to visit her and essentially are patronising to her.
And the ensemble acting?
Very, very good. I mean, it's really about the two pairs, mm-hmm. and the way they almost swap places and the relationships change and the power dynamics change. So when Hannah is photographed by Alfred, she discovers her sexuality, and a whole new sense of a kind of rage emerges in her. And that's the part, I think, where Siobhan Cullen is at her best, because she's got that toughness.
Obviously she's very repressed in the beginning.
In the first half, she's all constraint and, you know, corseted in her grey simple robes and all of that. And she breaks out, let's just say. And then she realises, you know, that she's been living a lie in this marriage, or she's been possibly colluding with, you know, turning a blind eye to things the way you do, as in, how clean is the source of the money that you know fuels her life, right.
And what
her whole
going
life.
To do about it?
And what's she going to do about it? Yes.
So Helen, what do you think? Would you recommend it?
I really recommend it. Yeah, I think it's very meaty and substantial. Lots of themes, possibly maybe overloaded with themes, but at least they're all really interesting and they're very current to today. If you think about any aspect of, you know, whether it's funding for arms, or, you know, whether you're talking about fossil fuels, or all the ways that we're now trying to put our distance ourselves from various types of acquisition of wealth. It's very, very relevant.
So the audience don't get off the hook by thinking it was way back then.
Oh no, it's very much about today.
Well, Helen Meaney, thank you so much. Helen was reviewing The Sugar Wife by Elizabeth Cootey and directed by Annabel Cumman. That play runs at the Abbey Theatre until July the 20th. For further details, go to abbeytheatre.ie. Time for album reviews, and this week we have a live album from Lancome, a return to music for Kate Nash, and Irish producer and DJ based in Dubai, Sean Warner. Following the release of their universally acclaimed Mercury and Ivor Novello Award nominated fourth studio album, False Lancome, which collected Album of the Year honours from The Guardian and the Choice Music Prize, Lancome released Live in Dublin, recorded across three sold out nights at Dublin's Vicar Street. The album features Lancome performing songs from across their catalogue, including The Rocky Road to Dublin, which up until now has never been officially released. Next, London and LA-based Brit Award-winning singer, songwriter and actor Kate Nash achieved huge commercial success with her 2007 debut, Made of Bricks. That featured the hit single Foundations, which reached number one in the UK and spent 7 months in the top 40. She later starred in HBO's hit wrestling drama Glow. Today sees the release of her fifth album, Nine Sad Symphonies. And finally, Sean Warner released his fourth album, Morning Light. Sean is originally from Galway and is now based in Dubai and DJs across Australia and the Middle East. But we're going to start with Lancome, and I'm joined by Louise Bruton and John Marr. And let's listen to a little bit of The Rocky Road to Dublin.
I'm a curious style, what set your heart a bubble and ask me was I hard? Wages I required till I was almost tired of the rocky road to Dublin. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road and all the ways to Dublin. Whack for
That's The Rocky Road to Dublin from Lancome, from Live Lancome, their live album, which was recorded over three nights, John, in Vicar Street.
It was last May, I think, a number of weeks after False Lancome, their fourth studio album, was released. And that was an album that has just attracted so much positive critical adulation. And in a way, I suppose these shows kind of feel like a victory lap, because they have been a preeminent folk band and alternative rock band from this country for several years now. And Vicar Street feels like something of a home from home. I saw them play there a few months before these shows, and they were very special concerts. And you can hear that they're in their own natural special place when they're on stage.
So, Louise, how much between tracks chat do you get? What kind of atmosphere do you get from the live version of these songs?
There isn't a huge amount of chat, but the small bit of a chat that you get between songs, because songs could go on to 12 minutes long now on this album, but you get to see a side of the band that you wouldn't get on record. This is when you get to know the personality of the band. And anybody who sees them live is very aware of that. But if you're someone who only listens to records and doesn't go to live shows, you may not be aware of just how funny and engaging and just how deep in kind of Irish culture and mysticism that they are. And as they joke around, they kind of bring this lightness to a lot of the darkness that the music does carry with it. And hearing the embrace of their fans as well is very special. And like John was saying, being in Vicar Street, being surrounded by so many people that they probably know and so many people who just love them so well, it's this amazing exchange of electricity between the stage and the floor. And that's just a great way to add an extra dimension to the band if people haven't seen them before.
Yes, because Lancome, I know, did a session with Arena a few years ago, and then just recently Dara and Cormac and Rady were in, and they're so chatty and kind of finish each other's sentences, and they have that great, they're so steeped in the source material of where they get these songs.
Yeah, they really are. And I think what has made them very special, particularly in the UK, where they are critically adored. I mean, you kind of mentioned the Guardian's accolade of giving them Album of the Year. I mean, that's no small feat. They thoroughly reinvent these old songs. You know, something like The Wild Rover, it's so much part of the fabric of Ireland that it almost feels stale. Do you know, what new can you do with it? And then you listen to what they do here, and the reinvention is spectacular. And it's the harsh beauty of Lancome. There's nothing pretty about this music at all. It's just really, it's visceral, it's raw. There's a touch of the gothic to it. It's otherworldly at its very best. And so much of that centres on Rady Pete's vocal, which is incredibly distinctive. And I think that really shows itself on stage. Even though Spud Murphy, who is their de facto fifth member and is their sound engineer, you know, he helps to create their sound in studio, I think he's kind of allowed the rough edges to remain even rougher at these Vicar Street recordings, and it's all the better for it.
When you a live album, what were the quality of the songs? Were they as fresh and beautifully produced as they are on the album?
Well, yeah, it's incredible that they have managed to capture both the performances on stage as well, and also the kind of reverence from the crowd when these songs are going to these deep depths that they are descending into. And it's great to be able to hear their musicianship
just happening naturally, because they do, they give their all. You know that this isn't if one person slips off on this second, which they never would. They know how to kind of roll with the punches, and you get that from the songs. And it's seeing just pure musicianship and their relationships on stage and the dynamics that they have working for them.
And John, are we saying that the Wild Rover, this is the first time it's been recorded and put on an album? By them, I mean.
It's either that or the Rocky Road to Dublin. I can't remember which. Mm-hmm. It's the first time, because both of those songs have been part of their live repertoire for many years. So I think it's just a case that they haven't got around to recording it. I mean, there are so many songs that they have played live that haven't appeared on their four albums to date. So there is a sense that both of those songs tend to be crowd favourites. For me, Go Dig My Grave is an extraordinary moment, not just on False Lancome, it's the opening track and it sets the scene, but here as well. And again, Rady Pete, she finds something vocally that is extremely rare, and you can hear a pin drop. That cliche, it's completely true. And I remember seeing them play this song live, and I mean, the sound you hear is the whirring of the fans at Vicar Street to try to cool the place down. That's all you can hear. And her voice, the rawness of it, particularly when there's no musical accompaniment, the sense of a cappella, chanos, it's all there, and she does something completely magical.
Yes, you are right. It is the Rocky Road to Dublin, which up to now has never been officially released. Let's have a little listen to Wild Rover. That's Wild Rover, performed live there in Dublin at Vicar Street by Lancome. Stars from you, Louise.
Well, I think when every single one of their studio albums has been a 5-star release, I think you have to say that this is probably a 10-star release.
Okay, what about you, John?
I'm going to give it 4 stars. I think it's very special in its own right, but I suppose for me, live albums just don't have the same resonance as studio albums do, but it's a very fine document.
So a 4 and a 10 for Lancome Live. I think that's
pretty
good.
I didn't know we could go up to 10.
I didn't either. Sean isn't here. We won't say anything. Next, we have Kate Nash. On her 5th album, 9 Sad Symphonies, she proves that she's still the unrepentant voice that emerged some 17 years ago with her breakthrough hit Foundations. Can you summarise what has happened to Kate Nash since that time?
So, yeah, Kate Nash, she signed her first record deal when she was 19. And I think a lot of people will be very familiar with her song Foundations, which has that brilliant song, that brilliant lyric, "You must eat so many lemons because you're so bitter." And along with Lily Allen at the time, she represented normal girls everywhere, albeit with a very, very London twist. Normal feelings and normal surroundings. But while Lily Allen had reached these skyrocketing levels of fame, Nash kind of had some difficulties in terms of fitting in with the industry. She was dropped after the release of her second album, My Best Friend Is You, an album that was hugely inspired by Riot Girl music and Motown. And then there was some misspending of her funds, according to the Guardian, and then she found herself having to move back in with her parents. So with such great heights at the very start of her career, a lot of struggles came her way, but she kept working in ways that would surprise a lot of people. She continued releasing music, obviously, but she also became an actor, starring in the Netflix series Glow, which is a really, really enjoyable watch, but was cancelled just after its second season, which was too soon for it. But most interestingly, she co-created a musical called Only Gold with the Hamilton choreographer. And with the producer that she was working with on that show, she ended up working with him again to produce this album, Nine Sad Symphonies.
Okay, and that leads us to 9 Sad Symphonies. Let's listen to Millions of Heartbeats.
I love you.
That's Kate Nash's Millions of Heartbeats, and that's from Nine Sad Symphonies. So, John, Nine Sad Symphonies, that sounds like nine sad songs.
It does, although we get 10 tracks here. It's a very giddy album, production-wise. It sounds to me like musical theatre. There's a baroque aspect to it. There's a lot of orchestration. It's a kind of a maximalist approach.
That's where the symphonies comes from.
Yeah, I guess so. And that song, that opening song, I liked it. I have to say, it's one of the few things I liked about the album. I just couldn't get with this. And I've kind of liked what she's done before. As Louise said, that, you know, she's not been afraid to try completely different things, which I always think is admirable in an artist. And she's a really good actor as well. The thing with this is it's her first studio album in 6 years, and there's a sense that she's trying something very, very different. I just felt that the songs were quite weak, and that all of that orchestral flourishes didn't disguise what I felt were the limitations of the material.
Very weak songs.
Oh, yeah, no, big heart disagree here now. I think that the musical theatre background that she has now experienced has really fed into these songs in a way that each song has a life of its own. And I could almost imagine Julie Andrews singing every song here. There's a huge level of sweetness that I think Kate Nash has always had. And I feel that she's the perfect musician to introduce a little sister to, because she embraces feelings, she embraces struggles in a way that's very relatable, but also she offers solutions. So while there is 10 sad songs here, there's also 10 solutions to get through it.
And what's she singing about? What is it that makes her sad?
Well, there's one particular song that I think is a true standout, which is Ray. It's written from a hospital bed where she was having some mental health issues. And it starts off with tick, tick, tick in my head. Do I really wish that I was dead? Which is devastating. And it follows on with a very poignant line. I could be a ray of sunshine. Anytime I want to see a rainbow, I just have to cry. Which I think there's just something in it that is, there's sort of a skin tingling quality to her music, where I think that she's very aware of who she is. And I think that a lot of people could resonate in the lyrics to be more comfortable in themselves.
Okay, let's listen to some of Ray.
Tick, tick, tick in my head. Do I really wish that I was dead? I'm coming back from all the things.
That's Kate Nash and Ray. John, a song you could introduce to your little sister.
I feel like I've just kicked a puppy.
Yes,
after what I said, I've written
squealing over in the corner.
I've written here, but her observations are deathly dull. Another song, a risible piano-led concoction that sounds like it was conceived for a piece of musical theatre that never made it to the West End. I kind of feel horrible. That song, Ray, I think is one of the better songs, and I do share Louisa's sentiments on it.
There's two songs you like.
That is two songs, but out of 2 out of 10, I just couldn't get with this album. And it's one of those things, as a critic, that sometimes you straddle that line between subjectivity and objectivity, and maybe subjectivity won on this occasion, where I thought, I just don't like this album. But I can kind of now appreciate that there are aspects that are good. But will I listen to it again? No.
Louise?
Oh, I think I'll be listening to this one a lot. I've been telling people that, you know, I wouldn't always be sharing every review that I go, oh, you must listen or you shouldn't listen. But this one, I think that there's just something very, very sweet about it. And it's very fun, because there's one song called Horsey, which uses this very fun clip-clop kind of beat. And I think it captures the two sounds that she's going for very clearly in this album. One, big and dramatic, that'll be the musical theatre. And then two, simple Americana folk. And she nails it. And yeah, it's a great chapter, I think, in her musical career.
So stars from you for Nine Sad Symphonies for Kate Nash. Louise?
That's 4 from me.
4 from you. And John?
It's 2 from me.
Okay, 2. That's Kate Nash. Now we're on to our last one. This is Morning Light from Galway DJ and producer Sean Warner. Sean Warner has quite a journey from Galway to Dublin to Australia and then Dubai, John. How do you think these experiences have influenced the sound?
Well, there's certainly a global feel in that it kind of feels homogenous. Like it doesn't feel like it's of any particular place. And I'll be honest, Dubai is something of a cultural wasteland. In many respects,
from your experience or from what you hear
from what I hear, certainly, like let's be blunt, from a music point of view, it's not somewhere that leaps off the page in terms of something that is a musical hotspot globally. I have to put my hands up, Sean Warner. This is album number 4. This is the first time that I have heard of him. I don't know if that's the case with you, Louise, but it's not a name that has registered at all up to now.
No, it's not someone, and I would be quite familiar with a lot of the Irish dance music that's been made, and Irish dance music has always been in a healthy state, but most of it has been underground. But there has been a big resurgence now in commercial music, when a lot of the clubs closed due to...
Yes, you said dance music suffered so much during lockdown didn't come back.
Clubs closing, clubs just not reopening at all. But a lot of producers, now that so many of the softwares and tools are accessible, so many people can become bedroom producers, which means that there's a huge wave of producers now emerging from Ireland, like Belters Only, Jazzy, 49th and Main. And these are all newer, younger artists on the rise. And Sean Warner, like you said, it's his 4th album. But he will fit in with this more accessible dance trend. And his latest single, Chills, is probably one of those. It features the vocals of David Owens, who was just a busker he met on Grafton Street.
OK, let's listen to some of Chills.
I'll be a stranger. We can pretend that we never met. Sit at the bar alone, your black boots on, a slave to your Dior dress. You know that I'd never tame you. I know you see I'm up to no good.
So that's David Owens there on Sean Warner's Chills from his new album called Morning Light. There's also, John, a collaboration with Jay Nada, who sings in Swahili, which is, we had Kiru on last night, who also sang in Swahili. I mean, that must give it an international.
It does. And in fairness to Warner, he's very good at splicing different genres together. Like there is real, he clearly has great craft at the mixing desk, and I do like the international feel, but to me this album, which is an extremely short album by the way, it just doesn't hang together particularly well. It feels like a disparate collection of songs that are kind of flung in together and released, and we call it an album. And this is a very catty thing to say, but the cover looks like something that was put together in 5 minutes.
Okay, John is not happy. Stars for you, John, for Sean Warner.
Two.
And Louise?
I'll echo John with 2 again.
2, okay. Not a great night for Sean Warner and Morning Light. And the other album we looked at was Kate Nash's 9 Sad Symphonies and Lancome, which we all loved, which is live in Dublin. Louise Bruton and John Marr, thank you so much. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Barbara Rose Sanmo. Mark Dwyer is on sound. Ali Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.